In that first year of Aeneas's death, his captains and old companions, particularly Achates, were my mainstay. Though my dear Maruna, the women of the household and friends such as Olivia, gave me most generous, loving sympathy and support, I wanted most of all to be with Aeneas's friends, because it was a little like being with him. It was the tone of the male voice, the way they moved, what they talked about, even the Trojan accent that comforted me. Among them, he didn't seem so far from me. Achates had loved him. I will say this, though my heart resists, as much as I loved him, and for years longer. I am sure Achates came very near suicide that summer. He blamed himself for the incident at the ford. He should have insisted they wear cuirasses. He should have been closer to Aeneas during the fighting. He shouldn't have let Aeneas release the young man, should have followed the young man and kept an eye on him, should have seen the weapon lying on the ground. Everything that he could blame himself for, he did. It was Achates who first told me, when they brought Aeneas home, what happened at the ford. Now I found that by letting him tell it over, he could talk out some of his shame and rage, and strange as it may seem, I wanted to hear it again, to hear it told over and over, till I could see it as if I had been there, as if I were Achates, as if I had knelt by Aeneas, had pulled the terrible blade out of his back, and held him in my arms, and watched his blood color the shallow water that ran among the rocks. He wasn't dead. He held on to me. But I don't think he saw me, Achates said. He was looking up at the sky. When we picked him up to lay him on the litter, he closed his eyes. He never spoke. He never spoke, but he wasn't dead then. So long as Achates told me the story, Aeneas wasn't dead. Ascanius, almost distraught with his new responsibilities, was at first jealous of my being with the Trojan captains. They were his men, not mine. He needed them for advice and to do his bidding, and they had no business loitering around the Regia with women. He ordered Achates to go up to Alba Longa and govern there. Achates accepted his order without a word, but I was afraid for him. I went privately to my stepson and asked him to send Nestius or Serestus, who knew the settlement better and would have no objection to leaving Lavinium. "Let Achates stay here, at least till next year," I said. "He goes daily to Aeneas's tomb. Let his grief heal. He has no heart to go to Alba Longa."
"You want him here with you?" Ascanius asked dryly.
"I have noticed that some men whose sexual interest is in men, not women, believe that all women are insatiably lustful of men. I don't know whether this is a reflection of their own desires, or fears, or mere jealousy, but it fosters a good deal of contempt and misunderstanding. Ascanius tended to look at women that way, as his ardent wish to keep Aeneas's memory unsullied led him to suspect me with every man. I knew that already. It outraged my honor and disposed me to feel some contempt in return for Ascanius. But neither anger nor scorn would do me any good. I said, "I wish I could keep all Aeneas's friends and his elder son here with me. But I've been afraid Achates may take his own life in his grief. I beg you to let him stay here with you, at least through the winter, and send someone else to Alba Longa."
"I wish I could go myself," Ascanius said.
He strode up and down the room we were in. He didn't look much like his father, but sometimes he moved like him.
"I meant it as an honor for Achates," he said. "The chief city of Latium is going to be Alba Longa, not Lavinium. The situation is infinitely better. Higher, better land, and central to where our power will be when I finally get real control over Rutulia. I thought Achates would take it as an honor. But if he is as broken as you think, I'll send Nestheus and Attis. So you need not kneel, mother. For I had been ready to go down in the formal posture of supplication, holding his knees. I knew he wouldn't have held out against that. He wasn't a hard young man, but kindly by nature, and easily swayed, though rigid about hierarchy, formalities, anything that supported his uncertain self-esteem. And it wasn't easy for him to keep up that self-esteem here in Lavinium, where the people endlessly mourned Aeneas, honored old Latinus, loved me as daughter and widow of their kings, and resented him. Trying to emulate Aeneas's authority, he was harsh in manner, and often arbitrary in judgment. It was a difficult year for him, even though the harvest was superb, and all Latium remained peaceful, with little of the raiding and boundary jumping we had all feared might follow the death of a king at the hands of outlaws. The winter was a dark one, with long, cold rain, snow up on the hills, and even on the Piedmont farmlands. I learned at last to weave well that winter, for if I had no work to keep my hands and mind occupied, I could do nothing but hide in my room and weep. I feared for the first time that I had my mother's weakness, her madness. At night I went into dark places in my mind. I went down underground among shadows and couldn't find the way up and out. In my room in the darkness, I heard babies weeping underfoot. I dared not take a step, lest I step on a baby. I haven't told this all in order as it happened. It is still hard to speak of. A month after Aeneas's death, I lost the fetus that might have been my daughter. Only my women knew that I had been pregnant, and that the pregnancy miscarried. Only my women and Aeneas knew. I went with Maruna in the dark before dawn, and we buried the tiny scrap of life that hadn't lived, deep under the great stones of Aeneas's grave. Ascanius went often to Alba Longa, and in the second summer after Aeneas's death, not long after he celebrated the parentalia for his father with all due ritual, he moved there. Trouble had flared up on our borders. He wanted to govern from Alba, a more defensible position. He took with him the Penates of Troy, and Silvius, and me. He left Nestheus and Serestus in charge of Lavinium. Achates chose to stay there, as did most of the older Trojans. The men who followed Ascanius were his particular friends and intimates among the young Trojans, such as Attis, who had been his childhood sweetheart, and the group of young Latins who formed his guard and captained his forays. Many of these men were still unmarried. If they had wives, they brought them and their household along to settle in Alba. I was allowed to bring 20 women as my retinue. As Ascanius had no wife, we were given all the woman side of the Regia, a much bigger and finer house than the small one Aeneas had built in Lavinium. Ascanius's high house was imposing, and the sight of it was more than imposing. It was like living in the sky. From the walls and roofs of the citadel, you could look right down on the great lake and across it to the eastern wall of the crater. Farther down the mountain, the young vineyards were thriving, as Ascanius had predicted, and the town that sprawled out below the citadel was thriving too, full of activity, building, the coming and going of armed men. I felt exposed there, always. There were too many great ashen slopes, too much sky, no shade. The water of the lake didn't move, didn't speak, like the waters I knew, but lay silent, blue, hard.
I felt isolated there. I felt useless. I ran the household for my stepson, of course, obtained and trained slave women to do the housework and cooking and cloth-making, and saw to the rites and festivals, as always. I would have attended councils and dinners with the men, as I had done in my father's house and my husband's, but I wasn't wanted there, nor did I belong there. Mars ruled in Alba. The talk was all of war, even in the winter season, when there was no fighting. It wasn't that Ascanius sought to be continually in arms, but he seemed unable to avoid combat, and combat was continually offered along our southern and eastern borders. He met every threat or challenge at once with counter-aggression. He followed victory with vengeance, defeat with renewed attack as soon as possible. Truce was rare. Peace was gone. He provoked even old Evander to break the alliance. I think he might have been crazy enough to quarrel with the Etruscans if my father hadn't prevented him. Latinus kept up a strong friendship with Caere and Veii. He let Ascanius know that if he imperiled that bond, he might have to prove his claim to co-rule Western Latium. He was deeply angry with Ascanius, not least for dragging me and Silvius off to Alba. He came once to visit us there. It was a hard trip for him, for he was an old man and lame with old wounds. He had given Aeneas and me most of his valuables. He came in what state he could, with what few were left of his companion guards, late in December. He accepted Ascanius's welcoming honors stiffly. He sat with the young men at the feast table and hardly spoke, the servant said. Whenever he could, he would come sit with us in the courtyard, or at the fire in the weaving hall, and talk with me, and study his grandson. Silvius's favorite toys at the time were two big acorns and their cups, and a curious little knot of wood he had found that looked slightly like a horse. With these he was playing most intently down on the hearth, whispering a story about them under his breath. Now and then we could hear a bit of it.
"Go on, drink." "No, the fat one said not to. Look, is it a house?"
"This is a fine boy, Lavinia," my father said.
"I know," I told him, laughing at the lovably predictable. It was good to laugh. There was little to laugh about in that house.
"You bring him up well."
It was a statement, not an order, but it had a sound of command or warning in it. "I hope to bring him up as Aeneas would." Latinus nodded vigorously.
"Right," he said. "Stay with him."
"I do, father."
"Your husband was a great warrior, but he sought peace."
I had thought myself past it, but the tears welled. I fought the sob and didn't speak.
"His son might govern well in peace," Latina said, "but he hasn't the patience to fight wars. Don't let him have the training of your son."
How could I prevent Ascanius from taking over Silvius's upbringing if he wanted to? I had no power. "I wouldn't have come here if I could have stayed in Lavinium," I said at last, trying to keep my voice from pitiable quavering.
"I know, daughter. It was best that I not interfere."
I nodded agreement.
"But if the time comes that you must, that you know it right to go, then take your gods and your child and go. Will you?"
"I will." I thought he was telling me to come to him, but he said,
"Tarchon of Caere will take you in and treat you with honor."
"Oh, surely it won't come to that," I said, staring at him, shocked and startled.
"I don't know what it will come to. If he learns a few lessons of war and draws in his horns, all may be well.
He was Ascanius.
I tried again last night to tell him to leave Evander and Palantium alone. The old man is dying. The Etruscans will move in when he dies and take over the Seven Hills. In peace. No reason why they shouldn't. Except his impatience. Oh, I was a fool as a young man, but never fool enough to take on Etruria. The best allies we could have. How can I make him see it?
You can't, father.
Oh, look! Oh, look!
Came Silvius's little whisper.
They're giving him a golden bowl.
My father watched the child with a half-smile, but his eyes were sad.
Patience, he said. I need it as much as he does.
It was the last time I saw my father. He took cold, walking out in his croplands in the rain, and it went to his lungs. He died a few days later, the day after the Ides of January. I ordered horses and a few men to escort me and Maruna and Sicana to Laurentum. Ascanius, busy up on our border fighting the Marsi near Tiber, knew nothing of what had happened. I didn't take Silvius with me, for he had had a cough and fever for some days, and the weather was bitter with icy rain. The great laurel stood in its winter darkness over the fountain in the courtyard of my old home. The war gate still hung open, rusted on its unlucky hinges. All the people in Laurentum seemed old. There were no young faces or voices. I stayed only long enough to bury my father by the roadway into his city. I couldn't stay the 9 days of mourning. I had to get back to my son in the city of my exile. Ascanius was sole king of Latium now. Not all the Latin farmers were happy about it, but they made no protest or resistance. The pressure on our borders was insistent, and they wanted a single leader during war. And war was our lot for years to come. The Volscians and the Harnicae, hoping Latinus's death had weakened the kingdom, harassed the border farms and towns constantly. Before long, Comares of Ardea, who had come to see Aeneas as an ally and almost a father, took offense at Ascanius's arrogance. He began letting his Rutulians make raids and forays into Latium, and rebuilt his alliance with the Volscians. And, though it didn't yet bring any increase of fighting, the Etruscans of the great inland city Veii were sending groups of farm families to colonize the Seven Hills on the Tiber. They didn't occupy the little Greek settlement, but simply moved in all around it, building on both sides of the river, where Janiculum had been, and up on the hill they called the Palatine, clearing the forest along the riverbanks and pasturing their fine cattle all through the valleys. Many of the younger Greeks of Palantium moved to Diomedes' city in Arpi. Others came to settle in Alba Longa. Latium had long laid claim to the region of the Seven Hills, and all the south side of the Father River, as far up as Nomentum. Ascanius was bitterly irked by this quiet takeover, but he remembered Latinus's warnings and didn't defy Etruria. The Veian colonists offered excellent terms to us for salt from our salt beds at the river mouth, and showed no sign of wanting to expand further into our lands. They called the new settlement by their name for the river, Ruma. Aeneas's shield hung in the entryway of the high house of Alba Longa. Ascanius didn't wear it when he went out to war, or the greaves and gilt cuirass, the helmet with its maimed red crest and the long bronze sword. Once he said in my hearing that these forays by farmers, these squabbles with petty barbarian kingdoms, didn't deserve such mighty weapons, but should be settled with hoes and mattocks. I think the armor was too heavy for him. I saw Silvius standing in front of the shield, looking up at it steadily. He was 6 or 7 years old. I asked, "What do you see there, Silvius?" He didn't answer for a while, and then said, in a small voice, as if from far away, "I'm watching all the people in the great round place." I stood with him and gazed. I saw the mother wolf, the burning ships, the man with the comet over his head, soldiers killing soldiers, men torturing men. I saw a splendid thing, great arches of white stone that strode down from the mountains across valleys to the city, with its hills and temples. The city, Rome. I was afraid of the shield, but the child wasn't. The power that had made it and dwelt in it was in his blood. He put out his hand to the golden cuirass, following the curves and decorations with palm and fingers, smiling. "You'll wear it one day," I said. He nodded.
"When I know how," he said.
Silvius had a good deal of strength for a child. He wasn't boisterous, and rougher boys often mistook his quietness for meekness or timidity. If they presumed on it, they found out their mistake. He ignored verbal attacks, but he met physical bullying or threat with instant resistance and retaliation. Hit, he hit back hard. He was competitive. He loved all sports and games, rode and hunted whenever he could, and was a diligent pupil of Ascanius's old teacher of swordplay, spear-throwing, archery, and the other arts of battle. With boys and men he was serious, silent, and reserved. Only with me and my women and the little children of the women's side did he go off guard. The Silvius of the courtyard was merry, affectionate, mischievous, greedy for sweets, patient with babies, impatient with ritual duties, fond of jokes and silly riddles and nonsense rhymes. Everybody liked him. Even Ascanius liked him, half unwillingly. In those early years of his reign, barely out of his own boyhood, Ascanius lived in the glare of his father's name, forever trying to find his own glory, always outshone. He was too adoring of Aeneas's memory to be able to resent him, but he was envious and resentful of any other power or popularity, particularly mine. He felt that he must outdo his father, striving to be a brighter son, and here was I, the moon, effortlessly shining with the sun's reflected light, effortlessly beloved by my people, because I was one of them, and because they had loved Aeneas. However modestly I lived, hidden like a captive in Ascanius's house, he perceived me as a constant threat to his dignity, and believed I undermined his decisions. Our people were increasingly unhappy with the endless warfare that kept young men in danger and left the farms for old men to plow. How could they be happy with it? But Ascanius blamed their protests and reluctance on me. I poisoned his counsels. I whispered with the women. I turned the Latins against him. In vain, I behaved as a vestal, not a queen, doing nothing at all but look after the household and the altars. Still, I was at fault. It was a dull life, not a bitter one, but dusty, dust dry, with no spring of life in it except my beautiful, bright, thoughtful boy. He grew and thrived, and gave me a vein, at least, of tenderness and hope. There came a march when we Latins struck out at last at the Volscians and Rutulians, driving their armies right down to the coast, taking Ardea and Antium, and reducing them to beg for terms and accept our domination. Our men came back from that campaign in time for the April plowing, and were home all the summer. The harvest was good. In the knowledge of victory, Ascanius began to relax and show the benevolence that was his original nature. He invited me several times to feasts in his great hall, treating me with formal honor. A few times he even talked with me informally, very cautiously, but beginning to show a glimmer of trust. It was then that he told me a strange story, a prophecy I hadn't heard before. I will tell it as he told it. It was in the time when Turnus was gathering armies to drive the Trojans out. Aeneas was making ready to sail up the Tiber to ask help from Evander. In the morning of that day, Ascanius said, he and his father saw lying on the riverbank a great white wild sow with 30 white piglets suckling her. At once Aeneas called for a sacrifice, and at the altar he announced the portent. His new kingdom was to be founded in the place called White, that is, Alba, and his heir would rule there for 30 years. Neither he nor my poet had spoken to me of this prophecy. I knew only that he had been bidden to build a new city in Italy and name it for his wife. I didn't speak of that, since Ascanius cherished this portent of the sow as justifying his move to Alba Longa. It weighed strangely on my mind. I dreamed more than once thereafter of albino piglets who trotted by one after another endlessly, though their throats were cut and gaped open, bleeding dark clots of blood, and of a huge white creature gasping and wallowing on the grass, who had been bled dry and yet wasn't dead and couldn't die. The next year was a peaceful one, but then the Sabines joined with the Aequians against our northeastern towns and farms, burning, looting, and taking slaves as far into our territory as Tiber and Fidenae. 2 years went in fighting those people. Ascanius defeated them decisively in a long battle late in the year in the hills above the Anio. All the Trojans fought with him there. Achates, Nestius, Serestus, men who had fought before the walls of Troy when they were young. It was their last battle. The soldiers came home in the winter rain, lean and lank as old wolves, but victorious. Again Ascanius was genial and gracious in triumph. He summoned the Trojans from Lavinium to receive special honors in Alba Longa, and made sure that his younger captains treated them with respect. Though there had been little profit from this defensive war, whatever booty had been taken, he shared out among all the men who had fought for Latium, and he sent lavish gifts to Gabii and Praeneste in thanks for their aid. Along at the time of the dark solstice, he came back from a brief trip down to Ardea. He sent for me, and said to me, "Mother, I know your heart has never been here in Alba Longa." "My heart is where my son is," I said. "And beside your husband's tomb, I think." He said it gently, and I nodded. "You have ruled my household with grace and wisdom, and many here will grieve for your going, if you go. But I say to you now, if you wish to go, you may. I have asked for the hand of Khamer's sister, Salica, and she will come here as my bride in April. If you are here to show her the ways of the house and teach her the skills of housekeeping in which you are so outstanding, you would have our undying gratitude. But if you feel that it may not be wise to have two queens under one roof, or simply if you wish to return to Lavinium, which is your home beyond all question, built for you by my father, I wish you to feel free to make whatever choice you please." The pompous awkwardness and the good intent were very like Ascanius. I was sorting out his words, and a glow of hope was just beginning to rise in me and warm my whole soul when he went on. "And I'll keep Silvius here, of course, for his training. It's time I was a better brother to him, I who stand in a father's place to him.
No,
I said. He stared.
If you are bringing a wife here, it's right that I go. She should rule here. I'll go back to Lavinium willingly, gratefully, but not without Sylvia's.
He was puzzled, displeased. He had thought his offer entirely reasonable and generous.
The boy is 11, is he not?
Yes.
It's time he was brought up among men.
I don't leave my son. He is my charge from Aeneas.
You cannot be his mother and his father.
I can. I am. Ascanius, don't ask this of me. You will not part me from Silvius. I am grateful for your brotherly care for him. Have no fear. In Lavinium he'll be brought up in all the ways and arts of men by his father's companions and your Latin captains there. I think you know I haven't coddled him. Is he unskilled for his age, or lazy, or cowardly? Is he in any way unworthy of his father?
He stared again. I was the she-wolf on the shield now. He saw my teeth. He said at last, "This is unseemly."
That I should refuse to give up my son?
He will be here with me, a few miles from Lavinium.
Where he is, I am.
He turned away, baffled, repeating,
"This is most unseemly."
Few people, I suppose, had openly opposed his will since he became king of Latium. He had forgotten that there was still a queen. I stood silent. He said at last,
"We will speak of this again."
And as he left the room, he said hastily, almost shrewishly, "Consider your position. You cannot have your way in all things." He couldn't bear contradiction. He didn't have the strength that allows opposition. He could be generous only when his will prevailed. I saw even then that he would be immovable. I had justified his suspicions. He knew now that he had been right to suspect me all along. All the years I had done his bidding, served his household, bowed my head and held my tongue. I was a woman, therefore never to be trusted, never obeyed. I must be disregarded or defeated. When I went to my rooms in the women's quarters that evening, my head felt as if it were fuller of thoughts than my skull could hold. Yet I could think only of the one thing. Ascanius had ruled my life for nearly 10 years. I had done his will, not my own, and he had taken that for granted, as if I were a slave. Now he meant, without malice, but without need or reason, to take from me the use and purpose of my life. He wasn't the man to bring up my son, Aeneas's son. My father had said so, and I knew it was so.
"Is there something wrong?"
Maruna asked me when we were out in the urinals together, and I said, "The king sending me back to Lavinium." Maruna's face lighted up. "He means to keep Silvius here." She was silent. "I won't go without him," I said. After a moment, going to the basin to wash, I said, "And I won't stay here. Enough is enough." She came to stand by me, and I called to the girl, "Maya, come bring us fresh water, child." The 10-year-old came with a pitcher and poured cool water over our hands, while her little sister ran in with towels. They were Sicana's granddaughters. Not pretty children, but very bright.
"You'll come back with us to Lavinium, you two,"
I said to them, and they made big eyes, wondering what I meant.
"I will go,"
I repeated to Maruna, drying my hands. It helped calm me to say it aloud. "And with Silvius. Maruna, am I like my mother?" As usual, she paused before she answered.
In many ways, she said at last. Because I know how she went mad. I know I could go mad as she did. Tell me if you see me going mad. Promise you will.
I will.
I have my father in me, too. I think if I knew the madness was taking me over, I could stop it. But not if I lost Sylvia's. She nodded. I did indeed understand something of how my mother's mind worked in her frenzy. The ceaseless whirl of ideas, plans, schemes, the terrible irritation with anything that turned thought from its obsession, and with anyone who didn't understand it, and the curious sense of waiting in ambush. I remembered two pale gold eyes that shone of their own light. I was the she-wolf in the cave, standing stiff-legged, silent, in darkness, ready. Preparations for the marriage of Ascanius and Salica went forward at the same time as my preparations to leave the king's house of Alba Longa. I and my women left everything in readiness for the new queen, every grain bin filled, the chests of bedding and clothing full of clean, folded, fine-spun woolens and supple furs and fleeces, the sacred meal made ready, the altars dusted and the floors swept. There wasn't a moth, not a mouse among the stores, and every snowy lamb's wool rug on the floor was fresh. I had my pride. And also I wanted Salica to feel welcomed and at home. She was young, just 18, and though Ascanius would never mistreat her, I didn't think he would be a good husband. He had no sexual interest in women, and didn't like them as companions. He was marrying because people think it strange if a king doesn't take a wife, and because he wanted an heir to prove his manhood, perhaps to bolster his unadmitted rivalry with Sylvius. I had spoken at once, of course, to Sylvius about our departure, and we talked the matter over, for he was a thoughtful and intelligent child, and children have a wisdom of their own. I had thought he might volunteer to stay at Alba Longa, not wanting to quarrel with Ascanius, and because he saw obedience to his king and older brother as his duty. But he didn't. He said, "Let Ascanius rule here, and leave us free to rule Lavinium. I'm Latinus's heir, as well as Aeneas. I want to live in the West, and learn my lessons from my father's friends. Ascanius doesn't really want me here." After a while, he added with a regretful sigh, "But Attis says the horses here are a lot better than the horses in Lavinium." "Your father chose a colt for you, sired by his own stallion. I think that horse is there in the royal stables." He lit up at that. "So you see Latium with two kings again?" I asked him. "If need be," he said, grave as a man of 40, and then, "I don't want to be here without you." "And I won't leave you here. So that's settled."
"Him and his sow and his 30 pigs," said Sylvius.
"When we're in Lavinium, I will take you to the forest of Albunea," I told him, with a deep swell of anticipated joy in my heart, "where your grandfather Faunus may speak to you from the darkness of the oak groves in the night, as he spoke to your grandfather, Latinus."
"Tell me about Picus," the boy said.
And so I told him once again about the grandfather who became a woodpecker. He loved to hear the stories of his land and people here, as well as he loved to hear the old Trojans tell over their war with the Greeks. We were so content with our arrangement and imaginings that I persuaded myself Ascanius would see reason as I saw it. But when I went to him to ask formal leave to depart for Lavinium with my son, he was extremely angry and made no attempt to hide it.
"You may go," he said. "Sylvius stays here, as I gave you to know last month."
There was nothing for it
but supplication. Son of my husband, king of Latium, I said, and went down on my knees and took hold of his legs at the knees. I, who am daughter and wife and mother of kings, ask you to honor my will in this. Aeneas left me Silvius to bring up, and I will obey his sacred charge. You lose nothing in letting your brother go with me. You gain our love and gratitude. Reign here and over us, with your wife and your children to come, and may the powers that guard the wombs of women be favorable. Let Silvius live in his father's house among his father's old fellow warriors, and grow to manhood there. Then he will be worthy to come to you and serve you, if fate wills and allows it. It is very difficult to stand while someone is clasping your knees and pleading eloquently at you from below. The clasp puts you off balance, and your position is acutely embarrassing, all too much as if you were allowing oral sex. Perhaps some people are gratified by receiving a supplication, but I always hated it, and hoped Ascanius might find it as unpleasant as I did. I bowed my head down after I spoke, till my forehead was on his feet. He could move only by kicking me. He tried to shift his feet, but didn't kick. We were in his council room, and 10 or 12 of his friends and counselors were watching and listening. I shouldn't have challenged him among other people. If I had sought him out alone, he might have let me persuade him. But changing a command, giving way to a woman, he couldn't let himself be seen showing such weakness. "The boy will stay," he said. He shifted around enough that I had to let go of his legs. I stayed kneeling some little while, silent. It was a deep and uncomfortable silence. His young courtiers were no friends of mine, and most of them had no interest in Silvius. But most of them were Latins, and our people have a piety towards the bond of parent and child, as well as the habit of respect for the mother of a household. It was shocking to them to see me on my knees, more shocking to hear my stepson flatly refuse my plea. I stood up and gathered my white palla round me, facing him. I put the corner of it up over my head, as in a sacred act. I said, "Our wills in this matter are different, King." And I turned around and walked out of the council room. As I gained the corridor, I heard the men's voices break out in the room behind me, and as I went farther, I could hear Ascanius's voice, high and loud, trying to dominate them. I had defeated him morally, but that really made no difference. He was in control. I must get out of his control. There was no time to ponder further or prepare. I sent Tita to bring Silvius in from the exercise field, and Maruna and Sicana, and I gathered our women, 16 of the 20 who had come with us here 9 years ago, and the children some of them had born here, and a few others who had attached themselves to me, and told them to leave as soon as they could, to take different ways down through the hills, a few in each group, keeping unseen as best they could, and make their way to Lavinium. I sent for 2 light carts to be brought out, and a pair of mules to pull each. We loaded a few garments and things precious to us in them. I put Rosalba and her newborn baby in one, along with old Vestina, who was very frail now, and living in a twilight of the mind. Silvius and Maruna and I rode in the other cart. Silvius stood up with the driver and ordered him to put the mules into a trot. We were off, down the steep white road, within an hour of my interview with Ascanius. The short February day was ending when we drove into Lavinium. The little walled town with its citadel above the river looked very quiet and gray in the low light from the west. The narrow river reflected the sky like a shard of glass. Some of my young women, running cross-country, the way Silvia and I used to do, had got there before us,
They had roused the few slaves who looked after the Regia, got the doors open and fires lit on the Vestal hearth and in the kitchen and royal apartment. But the widowed house was cold and dank and dusty. All the clean bedclothes and soft furs and fleeces were back there in Alba Longa, and all the fresh food, too. The wheat and millet in the granaries was scant and stale. There wasn't room for all of us, as we kept arriving, and several women had to seek the hospitality of families in the town. But as word went round among the townsfolk, they got up a real welcome for us, bringing us all kinds of food and drink and comforts. "Little Queen," they called me, the way they had when I was a child. "Little Queen, have you come back to us then? Will you stay? Will you stay in your own city? And the king, our little king, Aeneas Silvius, look how he's grown." By the time Achates arrived to bid me welcome, I could give him at least a good fire and a bowl of warm wine thickened with meal and honey. Of all Aeneas's old comrades, I had missed Achates most. He was the kindest of them, the most brotherly. He had come up to Alba Longa often to visit with me, and I always rejoiced to see him and found him a wise counselor. For all his loyalty to Ascanius, I felt that he was secretly on my side. It was a blow, therefore, when he said, "But Silvius cannot stay here if the king forbids it." "The king," I said. "The king." And then I paused. At last I asked, "Who am I, Achates?" He looked at me, taken aback. I said, "I am your king's wife." After a long time he said, "Widow." He was a brave man. "And your king's mother," I said.
"My king-to-be."
"You owe protection to your king-to-be."
"Ascanius intends him no harm, Lavinia."
"He intends no harm, but harm will come to Silvius there. He doesn't belong there. It's not his seat in the realm. This is. Ascanius will be busy with his new bride, and she with him. No one there will look after Silvius's interest. Some of them are intriguers and no friends of his. I will not leave my young ram-lamb unguarded among strangers." The image made Achates cock his handsome gray head.
"Better say you don't want your wolf-cub brought up in a barnyard," he said.
Then he clearly wished he hadn't said anything so disrespectful to Ascanius, and frowned.
"The boy's older brother is his proper guardian," he said stiffly. "I know it's hard for you to part from him."
"Do me justice, Achates. When the time comes to part from him, I'll let him go. But the time hasn't come. He's young. He needs to be with true friends and teachers, like you. His father and his grandfather left him in my charge, and I will not give that up to anyone else." I thought I could sway him, but I couldn't. Nor would Aeneas's other old companions, when I talked with them in the next days, approve my keeping Silvius from Ascanius's court. I think they all thought that I was right, but couldn't admit it. The will of a widowed queen couldn't be openly allowed to overrule that of a reigning king. Ascanius hadn't treated them very well. He had left them to grow old, away from the center of power. He ignored them, except for the most formal recognition of their service. But they were Aeneas's men, and he was Aeneas's son, and his word was law. If Silvius had been older, they would have listened to him, for he was Aeneas's son too, and they loved him dearly. But as grown men, they thought they shouldn't be swayed by the will of a boy of 11. Meanwhile, we waited for word to come from Alba Longa. Daily I looked out from the walls, dreading to see a mounted troop ride down the hill road, soldiers with orders to take Silvius back with them, or Ascanius himself coming down from the mountain to play the Sky Father with lightning and thunder of wrath. However, the wedding festivities were going forward in Ardea and Alba all those days, and I think Ascanius found it undignified to be squabbling with his stepmother while welcoming his bride. He simply ignored us. So we had all the end of March at peace there in Lavinium, and I can't say how often I wept with both pain and joy at being there again, in my home, where I and my love had lived. I had brought Aeneas's armor and sword and shield in the cart. Sicana helped Silvius and me lift them down and carry them. Now they hung again in his own house, where they should hang. And we waited to hear from the house of Ascanius. In mid-morning one day, while I was at my loom starting a new piece, the girl Ursina came running in.
"A troop of armed men on horseback, coming down the way from Alba, Queen," she said. "About a mile away now. One leads a riderless horse."
For Silvius. I had made 100 plans for what to do when Ascanius sent for Silvius, but they fell to dust under the hooves of those horsemen. There was only one thing to do, and it was what I had done already. Run. Run and hide.
"Send Silvius to me,"
I told Ursina, a girl of 15 or so, wild and tawny as a lioness, Maruna's niece. She darted off. I went to my room and tied up a few things in an old palla, and when Silvius came panting in, I told him we were going to the forest to escape from Ascanius's men.
"I'll get horses," he said.
"No need. We're not going far, and horses are hard to hide."
"Get your cloak and good shoes and meet me in the kitchen." I gathered up a cookpot and some food in another bundle. Silvius came, and we were off. Maruna met us in the doorway of the house. I said,
"I hope he will not punish you,"
meaning all my women and the people of the house.
"Tell the king's men. The queen went with her son to the great oracle of the springs near Tiber to ask guidance of the oracle. That will keep them busy a little while."
"But you..."
"You know where to look for me, Maruna. The woodcutters." She nodded. She was desperately worried for us, and I was worried for her, but I couldn't hesitate. Silvius and I went down the street, slipped out through the postern gate of the town, and struck across the fields, across the last Pagus, following the course of the Prati into the wooded foothills, northwest, under cover of the new-leaved oaks. In time, we came to the old path from Laurentum to Albunea, winding along under the hills. Silvius wrinkled his nose. He could scent like a hound.
"Rotten eggs?" I asked.
We hadn't spoken at all, hurrying along in fugitive silence. He nodded.
"That's the Sulphur Springs."
"Are we going there?"
"Nearby."
We came to the forester's cottage, where Maruna used to spend the night, while the poet and I talked in the sacred grove. Trees had grown up and closed in on the high round hut, and I almost passed it without seeing it. The clearing and what had been the kitchen garden were rank with brambles and tall weeds. I called out. No one answered. I went to the door and saw the house was desolate. The woodcutter and his wife had gone elsewhere, or were dead. Silvius was into the hut and all around it with a child's quick curiosity.
"This is a good place," he said.
He put down his bundle on the doorstep. I had noticed how unwieldy it was as he walked with it, and it went down with a thud and a clank.
"What did you put in that?" I asked.
He looked at me a bit askance and opened up the bundle. He had brought his short bow, arrows, a hunting knife, and the short sword he used for battle practice.
"For wolves,"
he said.
Ah, I said. Well, dear son, I think maybe we are the wolves.
He thought it over, and the idea clearly pleased him. He nodded.
Come and sit down a bit,
I said, sitting on the doorstep and pushing the weapons aside to make room. A shaft of sunlight struck through the gloom of the pines and oaks all around and made it warm there. Sylvia sat down next to me. I looked at his thin brown boy legs and the shoes that were too heavy for his feet. He leaned his head against me.
They don't want to kill us, do they, Mother?
He asked, not with terror, but for reassurance. No, they want to part us. I am certain in my heart that it's wrong for me to let you go, but there's no way I can keep Ascanius from taking you to Alba, except by hiding you so he can't. He thought for a long time and said,
I could go live on a farm somewhere off in the country and pretend to be a farm boy.
You might. It would put the farmer's family at risk, though.
He nodded shortly, ashamed of not having seen that. I was ashamed, too, of involving him in any deceit. I said,
Listen.
I lied about going to the great oracle at Tiber. But I do want to consult the oracle.
Ours, my father's, my forefather's oracle, here, at Albunea. Maybe it will tell us what to do. I don't know if it will speak to a woman, but it might speak to you, grandson of Latinus, of Faunus, of Picus, of Saturn.
I stroked his hard, slight shoulder, still sweaty from our quick walk.
Son of Aeneas.
I kissed him. He kissed me back.
I won't leave you, he said. Never.
Oh, never and forever aren't for mortals, love. But we won't be parted till I know it's right that we part.
That's never, then, he said.
A bird sang out sweet from the dark trees, a long trill brimming with the lovely, ignorant happiness of spring.
Is this where we're going to stay?
Tonight, at least.
Good. You brought fire, didn't you?
I showed him the little clay fire pot I had filled from Vesta of the Regia and brought in a wicker sling.
Lay a fire on the hearth and say the prayers, I told him.
I swept out the hut while he did so, and we kindled the hearth fire together.
Your father grew up in the woods on a great mountain, Ida. Did you know that?
I asked him. Of course he knew it, but he wanted to hear it again, and listened intently while I repeated to him the little that Aeneas had told me of his childhood. Then he went off with his bow and arrows to see if there were any unwary rabbits or quail about. I went on cleaning out the hut and made us beds of young pine boughs I tore from saplings. There was no rubbish in the hut, only the tiny leavings of spiders and wood mice and some fallen thatch. Poor people have little to leave. There was half a broken earthenware bowl on a shelf. It had been kept. It was of use. I put in it the handful of salt I had brought from home, and set it on the shelf that would serve as our table. Silvius shot nothing, but had planned where to lay snares for quail in the morning, and brought 4 crayfish he had hand-caught in a streamlet. We garnished our millet porridge with crayfish. I wished only that I had been able to carry water from home, for the water of the streams all around the sulfur springs is vile to the taste. We slept rolled up in our cloaks. I slept long and well. At Albunea, even outside the grove as we were here, I was always spared from fear. Or rather, I felt fear, but it was entirely different from the sharp dread of losing Silvius, and from the endless alarms and anxieties of living. It was the fear we call religion, an accepting awe. It was the terror we feel when we look up at the sky on a clear night and see the white fires of all the stars of the eternal universe. That fear goes deep. But worship and sleep and silence are part of it. Silvius was away all next day, exploring the forest heights above the springs. I didn't worry about him. He was a sensible boy. There were no boars or bears this near the farmlands. And here, in Inner Latium, no enemies were near. Along in the afternoon, Ursina appeared at the edge of the clearing, quick and silent as a mountain lion.
"Aunt Maruna sent me,"
she whispered. She brought a jug of good water, a bag of dried fava beans, and a packet of dried figs and raisins. Tita had put that in for Silvius, having great sympathy for his love of sweets. "What did the men from Alba Longa do?" I asked.
"They asked about you. Aunt told them you had gone to Albanea of Tiber. The others think you did. The men went back to Alba yesterday. Aunt said to tell you this. They ordered Lord Achates and Nestius to bring Silvius to Alba when you come back to Lavinium."
I kissed her and asked her to bring a little wine for sacrifice tomorrow. She slipped off again as quietly as she had come. I sat on the half-decayed wooden doorstep in the spring sunlight and pondered. If I went back to Lavinium, faithful Achates would obey Ascanius's order. I could take Silvius back to Alba Longa myself and stay with him there, an unwelcome, unwanted, unwilling guest in Ascanius's court, struggling to protect my son from neglect, envy, and harm. I could do as my father had suggested years ago, make my way to Caere in Etruria, and ask King Tarchon to take us under his protection and help me bring up Silvius as a king's son. That was a truly frightening thought to me, but I made myself consider it. I was still thinking when I heard the little sparrow whistle that was our signal, and Silvius appeared. He was dirty, thorn-scratched and tired, had snared a big hare, and was proud of himself. He washed, I skinned and cleaned the hare, and we made spits of green willow and toasted the meat over the small fire in the hut. An excellent dinner. "Tomorrow evening we fast," I told Silvius. "We'll spend the night in the sacred forest."
"Can I see the cave and the stinking pools?"
"Yes."
"What do people take as offering?"
"A lamb."
"I could go get a lamb from the royal flock there by Lavinium. I'd make sure nobody sees me."
"No. We can't go near town. Neither of us. We'll make what offering we can. Tomorrow. The grandfathers will understand. I've gone there before with empty hands."